Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. Broadcasting from WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. When you're in the restaurant business, the restaurant becomes your home. Inevitably, your children grow up there, and if you're lucky, they join you in the family business and carry on the tradition. Ella Brennan, the matriarch of one of Louisiana's most prolific restaurant families, shares the story of how it all began. And Rick Blunt, fifth-generation owner of Antoine's, the oldest continuously operating family-owned restaurant in America, goes back 175 years to introduce us to his ancestors. Then we'll visit with Mark DeFelice, fourth-generation owner of the 100-year-old Pascal's Manali Restaurant, home of barbecued shrimp. We're keeping it all in the family on this week's Louisiana Eats. New Orleans has a long tradition of great women restaurateurs. Madame Begay, Leah Chase, and Ruth Fertel, to name just a few. Ella Brennan is a living legend in that category. Recently, Ella welcomed us into her Garden District home to share her story. Ella's legacy began with her older brother Owen, a visionary man she clearly adored. As a child and into her adult years, wherever Owen was, Ella was never too far behind.
He was a great guy. He was just, in my opinion, one of the extraordinary people. Fabulous guy. And I could remember him as if he was standing right there and hearing him talk. Because I followed him around as a little girl. He was 15 years older than I was. And I remember going to pick up my father at the ferry where my father would come home to work. He'd take me with him. You know, he died in 1955. I just making 30 when he died. I spent the years from high school through that time working with him because he was always interested in making sure I learned how to do something. He wanted the family to be in a business so we could take care of our mother and father in their late years. And so he, all of a sudden, one day bought a restaurant. When we first started, it was just basically my daddy and me. And then Adelaide and John came, and Dick, Dick was young. So by the time he finished school and went in the military and came home, there we were.
That restaurant Owen bought in 1946 would eventually become known as Brennan's. While the original location was on Bourbon Street, it wasn't long before the Brennan family found another building on Royal Street, which remains home to Brennan's today. Ella recalls the work her family put into that new location before opening in 1956.
The day we opened Brennan's on Royal Street, it was a smashing, huge success all over the country. It was extraordinary. It was so good looking. It was just a natural. I think of my father going down there and saying, this building, you don't have to do a lot to this building. Let's clean it up, get the nails out the walls, and let's get down to the basic, what's here? And just let the building speak for itself. Then they could decide what to do. We had this magnificent man, Charlie Gresham, who was a local designer, but had become a member of our family. We found him at the bar on Bourbon Street, and he was family ever since then. And Charlie understood how to do it. And I think it became naturally great.
With encouragement from her brother, Owen, Ella would go on to learn from the restaurant chef, Paul Blanger. Together, they created Brennan's signature dessert, the famous flaming bananas Foster.
My mother cooked bananas at home. Bananas were a big part of our daily staples in our house. She had many versions, but particularly when I remember, is she would just saute the bananas in brown sugar And I could just see us. We were standing in the kitchen in the restaurant. We were not behind the range or anything like that. We were standing right sort of in the middle of the kitchen. And we put this dish together, and they decided to flame it with the banana liqueur and rum. And we served it over ice cream. And I remember them taking it to the waiter, taking it to the dining room, and serving it. And my brother Owen said to me later that day, "Why did you put the ice cream on it?" And I said, I say to this day to him, okay, ice cream did pretty good, you know? And so that was just a fun time doing that. That was a typical day.
A typical day for Ella included rubbing shoulders with some pretty famous people. For instance, New York Herald Tribune columnist Lucius Beebe was no stranger to Brennan's. Inadvertently, Lucius helped conceive the famous meal, Breakfast at Brennan's.
Lucius Beebe was a frequent visitor to New Orleans, and he frequently stayed at the apartment above the Absinthe House. And this is a very elegant, bon vivant type, smashing guy. And somehow or other, we took to each other, and I was a kid, and he was a much older man, but he couldn't have been nicer to me. Owen had said, "We've got to do something to get this restaurant known and people coming here." And Mrs. Kies had just written Dinner at Antoine's. And he said, "What in the hell are we going to do?" And so Lucius started talking about, well, he was getting older, and he much preferred having a great meal in the middle of the day rather than late at night. And so we got talking about that and talking about that, and no one came up with the Dinner at Antoine's, Breakfast at Brennan's. Of course, they said, "Ella, do a menu." I spent a tremendous amount of time with Paul Boulanger on Sunday mornings when the restaurant was closed. And I would go down, because Paul wanted to go in and fool with the stock pots and the da-da-da-da-da-da, and we would sit down and have these massive cups of coffee. Paul had some of these wonderful two old cookbooks, which he eventually gave to me, and I kept them close to me because I was using them constantly. So Paul helped me with, he would go make one or two of these various dishes, and we'd say, "Oh, we can't do that, we can't do that, we can't do that." So we kept evolving what we could do.
Ella Brennan's education continued evolving too. Owen sent her across the United States and Europe to learn the restaurant business firsthand from the greats. When Ella moved to Commander's Palace in 1974, she took with her Owen's philosophy about the family business.
Well, Owen always said, you want a restaurant that New Orleanians will be proud of. They will want to celebrate there, and they will entertain their guests there, or their visitors. You want a restaurant that is more than just the neighborhood restaurant. So when we got to Commander's, we knew what we had to do. Of course, up to that point, we didn't have anybody running the kitchen. These guys were running it, and I wasn't very happy with it, neither was anybody else.
Days before Ella took over at Commander's, the popular food critic, The Underground Gourmet, had published a scathing review of Commander's Palace. The restaurant received no stars, just a black dot. This symbol became a great motivator for Ella to turn the restaurant around. She immediately got to work, bringing in a number of now famous American chefs, beginning with Chef Paul Prudhomme.
Paul, coming from the Bayou, was doing his version of what they were doing down in the Cajun country. And we were sort of melding them together. And I kept saying, "Paul, it's got to be a little bit lighter. It's got to be a little bit lighter." But basically, he's one of the most natural cooks you'll ever find. It's in him. I talk about magic in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
They either have it or they don't. And what do I mean by that? It's what they're going to put in. I mean, it's the seasoning. It's the selection of the dish to begin with, the raw material, where they're going to serve. And if they have this magic in their hands, they can take this wonderful dish and wow.
When Paul Prudhomme left Commander's to open his own restaurant, Ella had to search for a new great talent, and she found it in Emeril Lagasse.
I'll never forget when we were looking for Emeril, because Paul wanted to leave, and I really wanted a chef. I wanted somebody who could take that kitchen and really organize it better even than Paul could do at that time. Mm-hmm. And so along came this recommendation for Emeril. And I told the man, no. He's too young, doesn't have the right experience. Don't bring him down because I'm rejecting him now. Don't bring that young man down here and have me face to face have to reject this kid. He said, bring him down anyway. So he brought him down. And that's how we got.
The kitchen at Commander's Palace became a great incubator for budding chefs. That's the place legendary Jamie Shannon honed his chops.
Jamie literally grew up in our kitchen. He had gone to the CIA in New York. He was a little boy from New Jersey. He went to CIA and he asked the man, Tim Ryan, who's there today, who was newly running the school, and he said to him he wanted to go learn about American cuisine. And Tim said, we'll start in New Orleans. Well, when Jamie got here, he was working in the kitchen. Emeril took him on. And so Jamie was there. And when Emeril got ready to leave, I'll never forget, we had four guys we could take as chef. Any one of them could have done the job. Emeril said, that's the one. That's the one. He was a kid, still a kid, you know. He eventually grew up, but it took a long, long time.
Tragically, Jamie's time at Commander's came to an end all too soon when cancer claimed his young life.
It was just heartbreaking. He and T were on an airplane. They were traveling somewhere together. And when he was walking, T says, Jamie, your walking is getting worse and worse. You look like you're in very much in pain. They get in all the airplane. Uh-huh. So they got off and they started talking. And he was telling them how he was feeling. And said, man, you better go to the doctor today. I mean, let's get there. And that was when they found out. Yeah. But he was just one of the talk about magic in his hands.
So how is it that Ella Brennan had such great success in finding that magic and creating a lasting culinary legacy?
Well, I don't know how you do that. I mean, it just sort of, you go with your instincts. I mean, you go with what you feel, this person, how they talk to you about what they're doing, how they go fix something, and you see how they handle themselves in a kitchen, and you talk to them about how they want to run a kitchen, and you feel it, you really feel it in your gut. And you say, okay, this one. And I realized what absolutely fantastic mentors I had. Absolutely fantastic. The cooks, and then there was my older brother and sister, Adelaide and Owen. She mentored him, he mentored me. I mean, it was all each teaching each other, and I finally began to realize that's what it was all about. So when, in addition to running the restaurant, you could build these people and this team. And when they all realized how much they could do together and help each other and make, we have a school. We've been teaching for years now. When they sit down, we tell them, we ask them where they want to go. And if they sound like they're interested in something and they have some ideas, we try to progress with that.
The legendary Ella Brennan of Commander's Palace.
You've got the magic touch.
Ooh.
It makes me glow so much.
Ooh.
It casts a spell. It rings a bell. The magic touch.
A new Creole classic created at Commander's Palace during Chef Jamie Shannon's time is Shrimp Henneken, named for a dear family friend, Joe Henneken. Originally, Shrimp Henneken was served as a special, but guests quickly insisted that it would always be on the Commander's menu. It's a bit of work, as it's really a chef's dish, but home cooks can easily master the recipe, too. Buy jumbo shrimp, the bigger, the better. Peel them, and then as you devein the shrimp, cut a quarter-inch incision down the back. fill that cup with strips of tasso, and secure the tasso in place with a toothpick. The shrimp get a light dredging with seasoned flour and then are fried for about 30 seconds on each side in a little hot oil. Let the shrimp drain briefly on some paper towel while you whip up some crystal hot sauce Beurre Blanc. Don't worry, it just sounds intimidating. All you have to do is combine some minced shallot and garlic with some heavy cream in a saucepan. Simmer that together until the sauce reduces by half, frequently giving it a stir. Then, whisk in softened butter by the tablespoon, being careful that the sauce doesn't break. Strain the Beurre Blanc into a bowl, and here comes the wicked part. Toss the shrimp in that rich, buttery sauce. Put a little pepper jelly on each plate and top with the shrimp. Voila! Shrimp henequen. Aside from serving a commander's favorite at home, you'll want to use that Beurre Blanc to sauce all sorts of things. You'll see. It's even good on your finger. This recipe can be found in the Commander's Kitchen Cookbook and on our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org and itsneworleans.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and shrimp henequen makes for some good Louisiana Eats. What is tasso, and where did it come from? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is tasso, and where did it come from? Tasso is a kind of seasoning meat that comes from Cajun country. We never saw tasso in New Orleans until Paul Prudhomme came to work his magic at Commander's Palace. Tasso is a very spicy smoked piece of pork that originally was made from scraps left over from the boucherie. The Cajuns would preserve those scraps by rolling them in hot spices, then hanging them to dry in the smokehouse. A little piece of tasso works wonders in anything from a pot of red beans to that famous dish, shrimp henequen. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Celebrating its 175th year, Antoine's restaurant is truly a space of living history. Through war, epidemics, and natural disasters, founder Antoine Alciatoire and his descendants have maintained their elegant dining tradition. Rick Blunt, current CEO of Antoine's, is one of the youngest keepers of the family history. We sat down with Rick to talk about his family business, our nation's original restaurant dynasty.
My name is Rick Blunt. And I am fifth generation here at Antoine's. And the family name is Alciatoire. So my mom was an Alciatoire. But being a woman, you know, you get married and kids end up with their dad's name. So I'm an Alciatoire by blood, but a Blunt by name.
That's wonderful. Rick, it's quite a trick, though. The restaurant business is tricky, goodness knows. But to hang on to a business through succession, through death, through war, how have you all managed to do this?
Well, I don't know that there was ever a plan. I guess probably the best history is one that wasn't written in advance. But the single biggest reason that the family was able to make it this far is that there was a giant consolidation in the second generation. Antoine started the restaurant. He and his wife operated the little pension and the restaurant downstairs. And his son, Jules, a middle son, purchased the business and the real estate from mom after dad died. So when Antoine died, Jules bought the business. That consolidated the trunk. You know, that gave us a second generation that could be manageably passed to the third generation. Mm-hmm. And so Jules had three children. My grandfather was the youngest of those three kids. His name was Roy. And he was, I guess in this family, you get tapped on the shoulder or whatever. And so you're it, kid. And so Roy was tasked with running the family business in the third generation. He only had one child, and that was my mom. So in the fourth generation, his nephews, his sister's sons, ran the restaurant. They were the Gust family. They ran the restaurant for a very, very long time, since 1972, I guess until I took over in 2005. So that's a pretty long run. For you know, my cousins to have managed the family's businesses and stuff. I don't know that there was ever a feeling that that there was a way to make it work. I think it's kind of like walking. You just put one foot in front of the other and eventually you get there. But I don't know that there's any way to know in advance that it would happen.
Rick took us back to the very beginning of Antoine's family history, when a young Frenchman arrives in New Orleans and achieves quick fame because of his European culinary sensibilities.
If I were going to give you the very short version of the tale of the generations or whatever, the whole thing starts with Antoine, and here he is, this French immigrant guy who initially goes to New York and doesn't speak any English, so they tell him he needs to go to New Orleans, where at least they speak French. And he ends up in New Orleans as a very young man. And he almost immediately finds some success because of his ability to cook. He has gotten this experience in Europe of being able to make sauces. And that ability has endeared him to the New Orleans sort of gentry early on, right after he got here, that allowed him to find a job, to find a way. He's a hardworking guy. I think he gets sort of the American dream. I think that's what all of our ancestors who came from Europe did. He buys a piece of real estate. You know, he buys this little pension, and he works his whole life in his kitchen. And like I think all cooks did, he came to a cook's demise of his generation. He died of lung disease because everybody that cooked on a coal stove died of lung disease. So he ultimately dies. His son is a very, very different personality than Antoine was. Antoine's this really, really hardworking, diligent guy. Antoine marries a German lady, an Alsatian lady, who has the reputation of being very, very stern and so on. So, you know, I think she really ruled the nest here, and ran the business. After Antoine dies, his middle son, Jules Alciatour, takes over. Jules, very different than his dad. Egotistical. He's the president of his own fan club. He, you know, he likes being with the movers and shakers. So he starts the tradition at Antoine's of celebrityism. So he's the one that's going to the French Opera House and inviting the prize fighter to come to his after party. Because if he can get the prize fighter to come, he can get everybody else to come.
And the time period we're in?
We're in the late 1800s now. So Antoine's 1840 to 1875, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then his wife is in there for a while. And then Jules buys the business in the late, late 80s or early 1890s. And so then Jules is running runs the business for his whole life. Jules dies, and my grandfather is tapped to take over the restaurant. Completely and totally different than his daddy. Geeky guy. He would be a computer nerd if he was born today. But now he gets thrust into this very, very public career that he's not equipped for. He sees how his father's role has been in the business and so on, and he doesn't see that he could ever do that. But he did. He just did it different. Because of his personality, because of who Roy Alciatore was, Antoine's grew up. It went from the Wild Wild West show of Jules to this fine dining, mastering a million details that Roy's Antoine's was. Roy is really of the first three. Roy is the one that was most responsible sort of for the international reputation of Antoine's because he made it fine. So Roy has one real major failure in his life, in his career at Antoine's. Ran the restaurant for 40 years. Didn't figure out a succession plan. So when he's diagnosed with cancer, he works out a succession plan where he transfers the management of the restaurant to his nephews, to his sisters. Two of his sister had four sons, but two of his sister's sons. And Billy and Roy Gust took over the restaurant. They had a tremendous amount of love and respect for their uncle. And so they believed that that Uncle Roy had it right. So Billy and Roy's mantra of their management of the restaurant was that we know exactly how to do it. We're going to do it just like Uncle Roy. And so that has created a wonderful environment today because not very much changed. We actually got sort of stuck in a time warp where everyone was under this belief structure that all of the wisdom was in the past. You know, you were in the kitchen today and you saw the same pots that have been in the kitchen 50, 60 years. We don't own a modern appliance, not even one. We don't have anything to cook with other than a cook and a pot. So everything we do is done as if it was 1890. It's awesome to me, and we have these experiences, thank goodness we have them with relative frequency, which I love, that someone walks in and talks to me. You know, I'll find a couple that said, you know, we celebrated, we came here on our honeymoon to New Orleans, and we had dinner at that table right there. Where else can you do that in the world 50 years later? And it's still interesting today that these recipes, this way of dining is of interest to someone today, that it's good, that it's worthy of going to dinner.
Rick Blunt, fifth generation proprietor at Antoine's Restaurant. Today's Louisiana Eats dessert comes from Leah's Pralines, the French Quarter's oldest candy shop. Purchased by the glamorous Leah Johnson in 1944, Leah's Pralines is the quintessential quaint candy shop, as only found in the Vieux Carré. I stopped in at Leah's one rainy afternoon to learn more about the Johnson family's history with pralines. There, I met Elna Stokes and her daughter Susie, who's the third generation to work the family business.
Hi, I'm Elna. I've been running the shop for 31 years. It was my Aunt Leah's shop. Since 1944, it's been in our family in this location.
I'm Susie, Elna's daughter, and I work at the shop every day. I make candy, wait on customers, and do general management stuff.
Well, let's take us back to the start. Explain to me who your Aunt Leah was and how she became so well known for her pralines.
She purchased the shop in 1944, and her goal was to have the best pralines anywhere, and I think that's why she became well known, because quality and taste were what she was going for.
So tell me about this glamorous woman who was your Aunt Leah. You've got some photographs of her here, and in one of them, she's sort of looking like the archetypical businesswoman seated at a desk. And then there's a very, very elegant photo of her in an emerald green long gown. So tell me the history of all this fun
stuff.
Well,
my aunt was a model back in the day. John Robert Powers was the great modeling school in New York. She was a graduate of that school, and she was truly a glamorous and beautiful woman. And this dress, the long green gown, she was modeling that gown.
Oh, I see. And so that photograph then ends up on your box today.
Right.
What are your first memories of actually making pralines yourself? Because pralines are a tricky thing to make.
By the time my aunt sold us the business, okay, she was old and she was ready to stop working all the time. And she gave me printed recipes. The recipes had no instructions. It just was ingredients, all right?
Okay.
None of the people that used to make the candy were still living. We had to learn how to make the candy based on the recipes.
So tell me how your product selection and how things have changed here at Leah's Pralines since the time of your great Aunt Leah.
Well, when Aunt Leah ran the shop, she made traditional pralines, which we still use the same recipe. She made the frosted pecans, and they made the pecan brittle, which back then they called pecan flake. And since my mom started running the shop, we added many other things. We have a whole line of chocolates that we make here. We do turtles and chocolate dip brittles and various nut bars. The chocolates are really good. And then we also do a creamy praline, and our creamy praline is really creamy. It's almost like a fudge, but it's really soft and buttery, and that's something that was added later on. And the most popular thing we have that was added fairly recently is our bacon pecan brittle.
Bacon pecan brittle?
It's basically just the pecan brittle recipe, the one that we've been using forever. And then we take bacon and we cut off the fat and we render it, cut it up in small pieces and render it till it's really crispy and just add it to the brittle. And so it basically becomes this like sugar coated candied bacon with the pecans. And it's really good and it's very popular. I mean, that's probably the traditional pralines and the bacon pecan brittle are our two best sellers right now.
The equipment here. How old or how modern is the equipment? How much of the equipment here was from your Aunt Leah's time?
I know we have copper kettles that are from my aunt. But we also have a candy stove, the round candy stove. That was here when I was a little girl.
Would you show it to me?
Sure.
As we entered the shop's kitchen, I could see the staff busy at work, weighing and bagging freshly made pralines. Elna led me over to a corner where her aunt's beautiful old copper kettle sat. This is incredible back here. It is really exciting. I have never seen a little stovetop like that. It sort of looks like a Victorian crawfish boiler.
Well, it is a candy stove. It's designed to be a candy stove.
In that big copper kettle, about how many pralines or how much brittle will come out of that big copper kettle? And what is the size of it?
It's about 10 inches deep and 21 or 22 inches across. And a batch of pralines
is about 180 pralines. A batch of brittle is about 12 pounds. Now, you could cook more if you had a bigger place to pour the brittle. Uh-huh. But we do make everything in small batches, and we can control the candy better that way.
The table must have come from Aunt Leah as well.
This table has been right here in this spot since I was 12 years old. This marble top, this thing weighs so much, you could never move it.
Explain the importance that the marble makes.
Marble cools the candy. The pralines, we dip on the marble to cool it. The brittle, they pour it on the stainless steel table and stretch it because the stainless steel keeps it hot so it doesn't cool too quickly. So you can pour it, spread it, stretch it, and then we bring it to the marble, and then that will cool it even more, and then you can bag it. But the brittle you do have to do quickly because it gets sticky, especially on a really humid day like today. It's raining outside. The brittle will just get very sticky. When it's cooler, it's a little bit easier to work with.
We all remember Lucy and Ethel in the chocolate factory and their little disaster that they had. Have you had any disasters in your life here?
Candy disaster?
Candy disaster.
Well, sometimes we do have candy mess ups, but we have this little basket up front called the factory rejects basket. And everything in it is a dollar. So if we have a messed up batch of anything, it might not be to our standards, but it still tastes good. So we'll bag it up and sell it. Or sometimes if you don't get the pralines dipped fast enough, they get kind of thick and clumpy and they still taste good, but the texture might not be perfect. So we'll sell those. So that's the kind of nice thing about having a candy shop. There's not a whole lot of waste because anything that would be considered waste, you could still sell it because it still tastes good, you know?
Well, I mean, it's just that it's may not be absolutely perfect. So when we sell it for a dollar and the customers love it. I mean, customers love getting a piece of candy for
everyone
a dollar.
Everyone loves the factory reject basket.
Yeah,
it's hilarious.
It's really very popular, the factory reject basket.
I also want to ask you, what is your favorite childhood memory of growing up here at Leah's Pralines?
Well, you know, I'm struggling to remember what would be my favorite because I've spent my whole life here just about it. But, I mean, I remember when the parade used to go down Royal Street and we could just walk out the shop and go watch the parade on the corner of Royal and St. Louis. And that was really fun. I mean, I enjoyed that. And we could also, we lived in this building upstairs on the fourth floor. And we had not a balcony, but a rooftop that we could actually see the parades from, you know, just walking outside the apartment and we could see the parades on the corner.
My favorite time of year in the French Quarter is, you know, Christmas time. Like Royal Street around Christmas when it's cold, oh my gosh, at night, it's so wonderful. Like I just love that, you know, and it's like I have so many memories of being a kid, like, you know, the Christmas customers and, you know, the holiday bustle in the French Quarter. It was really fun, you know, so that's probably one of my favorite memories.
Elna and Susie Stokes of Leah's Pralines.
Now I'm back, this fun to sweet things, sweet things I adore.
When we come back from the next short break, we'll hear the story of New Orleans' second oldest continuously operating family restaurant, Pascal's Manali.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Amongst the prestigious ranks of New Orleans' oldest family-operated restaurants is Pascal's Manali, a traditional Creole-Italian restaurant where the legendary dish barbecued shrimp was born. Opened in 1913 by Frank Manali as a corner grocery on Napoleon Avenue, Frank's Italian-born nephew, Pascal Rodasta, transformed it into the restaurant we know today. We visited with Mark DeFelice to talk about his journey from busboy to owner and the restaurant's centennial old traditions.
I'm Mark DeFelice, and I am fourth generation of the family that operates Pascal's Manali Restaurant. And I am in partners with my two brothers, Bob and Sandy, and then my sister, Jenny. And then my dad is 91 years old, and he's the son-in-law of Pascal. My mother was Pascal's daughter. So we have four generations running, and we actually have some fifth-generation family members here.
Well, congratulations for making it this long, long way. What are your earliest memories of being here?
Well, I used to come here and with my parents and, you know, eat with the family. I'd come with my Aunt Frances and eat with my her husband, my Uncle Steve. I didn't come here every week or anything like that, but I used to come here. I remember coming here and sitting on Frankie Lane's lap a few times. He was a good friend of the family, and meeting some other celebrities here. And I came here for my high school prom, you know.
That must have been swell.
Yeah, and junior prom. I wasn't 18 yet, and that was the drinking age, but I knew people here. So, you know, I was able to, me and my girlfriend, we could sneak a couple of underage drinks, you know, at the time.
Really good to date the son of a restaurant owner. That's always a smart move. The walls of the bar at Pascal's Manali are covered ceiling to floor with photographs of the famous athletes and celebrities who've patronized the restaurant for decades. I asked Mark how Pascal's Manali attracted such a famous clientele.
Well, I think it was a combination of things. My grandfather knew a lot of people. He knew a lot of political people. And those political people knew some of the celebrities. People came here for various reasons. He knew a lot of people in the, a lot of fighters and a lot of horse racing people. Matter of fact, the man that helped my grandfather do the barbecue shrimp, invent the barbecue shrimp in the 50s, he was a horse man and trainer from Chicago. And he used to come down here every year in Chicago in the winter during the off season, but the fairgrounds was running. So they got to be good friends and came up with the barbecue shrimp recipe back in the early 50s.
Pascal's Manali is undeniably best known for its iconic barbecued shrimp, a dish emulated by chefs and novices alike all across the world. First-timers are often surprised to learn that barbecued shrimp are neither barbecued nor served in a barbecue sauce. The large head-on Gulf shrimp come in a rimmed soup bowl, dripping with a peppery, buttery sauce and accompanied by lots of crispy French bread to sop up every last drop. Diners are even robed in huge bibs before digging into a bowl of barbecued shrimp, as it's almost impossible to peel and eat those luscious crustaceans without making quite a mess.
Well, it was one of these things. My grandfather had this idea with this man, I think his name was Vincent Sutro, and they kind of collaborated in the kitchen, and my grandfather's brother, Jake Radasta, was running the kitchen at the time, and Pascal went to Jake and said, look, this is some ideas we got, let's try and play around with this. So they went back there and came up with the barbecue shrimp. They call it barbecue shrimp. It's not barbecued at all, but I think they do it because it has a little orange flavor, color to it. And, you know, for lack of a better word, they said, well, we're just going to call it barbecue shrimp. And my grandfather used to entertain a lot of his friends. He always used to serve them Italian food on Sundays. So he said, well, I'm going to try the barbecue shrimp on them. So he surprised them and gave everybody barbecue shrimp, and everybody fell in love with it and told them to put that on the menu. And it went on the menu almost immediately. And we've been serving it ever since.
And that was back in the 1950s.
Early 50s, like 52, 53.
So you started working here when you were 20.
Yeah.
What did you start doing? Tell me about your career.
I started here actually just to come part-time in college. And I came for a summer job. And I worked as a busman and with the intentions of going back to school. And I thought about it, and I said, well, I'm going to stay here. So I wound up, I went from busman to full-time working in the kitchen, and I worked with my great-uncle Jake, Pascal's brother, and he taught me, you know, tried to teach me everything. He knew he was a little up in age, but, I mean, I started learning from some of the other cooks. So I worked here a couple of years, and then we sold out to my aunt, Frances, my mom's sister, in 1978. So I went off to do other things unrelated to the restaurant business. And then in 1988, we had a chance to buy, my aunt was getting up in age and she didn't have any kids. So we wound up buying my aunt out in 1988. And so the family, we all came back here. And then I came back to the kitchen like I was in my early 20s. And I started back here in my early 30s this time. And I've been here now, it'll be 27 years this May we bought the place from my aunt.
And when it comes to employees, you have a lot of long-time employees here, don't you?
Yes, I do. We're experiencing kind of a turnover a little bit because some of them are just getting older to where they're retiring.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had a couple of people that have retired recently.
After how many years here?
Well, one was, we had a bartender here, was 35 years, and then Johnny, my mom's first cousin, he was here over 50 years. He retired, and then Katrina came, and then, you know, he never did come back. But I do have a couple of, I have three or four people in the kitchen that been here. One's been here for 40 years. We have a waitress that's been here right around 20 years. So we kind of start, you know, starting new. And I got a lot of people been here 7, 8, 10, 12 years.
One of Manali's longtime employees is their amazing oyster shucker, Thomas Uptown T. Stewart, who for 30 years now has been behind the oyster bar shucking the iciest, briny oysters that make Pascal's Manali one of my favorite spots for slurping down some raw oysters. Mark credits his father, who himself was an oysterman, as one of the reasons Pascal's Manali has built their reputation around oysters and continue to serve the very best in Louisiana.
Well, we from Plaquemines Parish. You know, that's where I grew up, and that's where, even though my dad is technically from Cut Off, Louisiana, but my dad was in the seafood business a lot, and by being in the oyster business, we know a lot of people down in Plaquemines Parish, and, you know, that's where I get my oysters from.
So there's the new employees now, and there's one new employee that I would really like to talk to you about. Tell me about who's waiting in the wings for Manali's future.
Well, I guess you're talking about Rachel.
I am.
My daughter. Well, like most of the kids, most of my nephews and nieces, they spent some time here growing up, you know, in the summertime working. And even as a young kid, Rachel would come in here, and because I work in the kitchen, they would come in the back with me. And I have two daughters, a younger one, Marcy. But Rachel, you know, she would come in and peel potatoes or peel shrimp and, you know, just peel onions, do the, all of the grunt work stuff, and, you know, I'd give her a few dollars. And then when she was old enough in high school to work, like most of my other family members would go out front, she started in the kitchen. So she started looking in the schools to go to culinary school. Mm-hmm. And so John Foss has a real great program, and it's a four-year accredited a Bachelor of Science degree. Mm-hmm. And so she started last spring, in January. So this is her fourth semester at John Foss Culinary School.
Oh, that's fantastic. So from where you sit right now, what does the future of Pascal's Manali look like?
What I'm hoping for, I would like to see maybe us get another place, you know, at one time. That would be nice. And we do have a couple of fifth generation folks that are interested, so maybe we might do something like that. Of course, we had Katrina, and we were out for about 8 months. So, you know, it's been a little hard to, you know, seem like we've been rebuilding over the last few years. And it's starting to pay off right now. Our business is doing, you know, pretty good. I think, you know, our immediate goal is to become busy every day like we were, you know, 10 years ago.
Mark DeFelice of Pascal's Manali Restaurant. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we visit with Matt and Ted Lee, whose Southern Empire all began with a simple boiled peanut.
Well, you know that smell when they're boiling on the stove, and it's sort of beany and mysterious and really appetizing to us, at least, growing up on them. Well, we conjured that up in a New York City tenement apartment and thought we'd sell New York on the hip snack of the 90s. That was an instant failure, but on the rebound, we started selling them to expatriates like us.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Bacardi USA and Dickie Brennan's Bourbon House. From oysters to redfish, serving fresh Gulf seafood on Bourbon Street and home of New Orleans' largest American whiskey and bourbon collection. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Chris Kehoe, and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eat studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.